Outstanding.
Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judges Larkin, Riley, Friesch, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Can everyone hear me all right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals this ninth day of July. I don't know if the attorneys have had the opportunity to participate in a hearing online. The procedure is the same. Each attorney will have 15 minutes for his or her primary argument. Appellate's attorney will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself immediately before your argument. The marshal will hold up an iPhone, which displays the time. There he is, so you could just make sure to watch for that so you know where you're at in your timing. And lastly, the one thing is difficult is recognizing when judges do have questions. I think we generally just raise our hand, so if you could watch for us to do that and try to sum up your statement so you could take a question at that time, that would be appreciated. With that, we are ready to hear from the attorneys in Bothman versus Bothman, the first case on the calendar. And who is appearing for appellant Daniel Bothman?
Good morning, Your Honors. Jack DeWalt appearing before appellant Daniel Bothman. That's DeWalt. Good morning, Judge Larkin, Riley, and Frisch. I want to apologize. I was laughing just very briefly that you prepare all the time to get ready for this, and then the moment's ready. The technology didn't work, so I apologize, and I'll get right to it. Again, I'm appearing on behalf of Mr. Daniel Bothman. Mr. Bothman undertook this appeal seeking a remand to the district court of the amount that was awarded to respondent in spousal maintenance as part of the party's dissolution decree. Mr. Bothman supports this request by two primary grounds. One is related to his income in the fact the district court erred by failing to make findings establishing appellant's net income when setting the amount of the spousal support award and then erroneously used outdated tax worksheets when creating that award. The second basis for the appeal, Your Honors, is when determining respondent's need for support, the district court also erred by failing to consider the income available to her from her share of the marital property award as is required by statute. Both of these errors are clear in supporting Mr. Bothman's request for a remand. Looking to the first issue of appellant's income, there are two things the district court did that were clearly wrong. First, the district court failed to make any findings of appellant's net income when establishing the amounts of support. This is required to happen as stated by the relevant and applicable case law cited in appellant's brief, including Kostelnik v. Kostelnik and Knott v. Knott. It is insufficient for the district court to simply state that there was a basis for its decision in the trial record, as the district court did here. In fact, the district court is required to set support based on that income, which did not occur. The second thing the district court did wrong was to create a factual error. It did this when it based appellant's support obligation on the tax laws as they existed in 2018 and not as they existed in 2019 when the matter was heard at trial. What was clear was that the district court used appellant's trial exhibit number 8 when setting the support award and not appellant's trial exhibit number 96. The difference is that Exhibit 8 was submitted on September 18th, 2018, and Exhibit 96 was submitted on or around February 4th, 2019. This difference is critical because, as noted by the district court in its judgment and decree, the tax laws as pertains to spousal support changed on January 1, 2019. The change is significant in this case because it shifted the tax burden from what had previously been paid by the obligee or the recipient of the support to be paid by the obligor or the payor. To say it in a different way, this means that appellant has less income to contribute to the support of respondent because he now has to pay taxes on that obligation, and respondent has more income available to her to meet her monthly needs because she does not have to pay taxes on any support that she receives. By using appellant's exhibit 8 in setting the amount of support, the district court created impossible outcomes. For example, As can be seen in the hypothetical scenarios outlined in appellant's reply brief, substantive brief, if assumed tax rates are applied, the income amounts established by the district court for the parties, it's clear that appellant cannot pay both his monthly needs, which were set at $3,500 by the district court, his support obligation of $3,500 as established by the district court, and his tax obligation on the gross monthly income he was found to have of $8,200. In fact, if you apply a reasonable tax rate to appellant's income based on the tax laws in 2019, not the worksheets the district court used from 2018, he will end up with approximately a $1,000 per month shortfall to pay his taxes, support, and monthly needs. The egregiousness of the error can also be seen when you consider that under the 2019 tax laws, as applied to the parties' respective incomes, as found by the district court again, respondent is receiving approximately 70% of the parties' combined after-tax income, while appellant is receiving 30%. In conclusion, these errors are clear and they are substantive. Unless the court has questions on that first issue, I will transition my argument to the second point that I would raise today. I'll move into the second argument then, which in essence is now looking at respondent's income. The district court committed clear error when it failed to consider respondent's available income based on the property awarded to her as part of the marital estate. This is coming out of statute 518.552 subdivision 2A and is again supported by cases such as Erlinson v. Erlinson and Novick v. Novick. 518.552 subdivision 2A states that when establishing the amount of spousal maintenance, a district court, and add the emphasis, shall consider, among other factors, the financial resources of the party seeking maintenance, again, emphasis added, including marital property apportioned to the party. And that is done when considering the party's ability to meet needs independently. Applying basic tenets of statutory construction, it is clear the legislature intended for a district court to consider the marital property awarded to the spouse when also considering their need for support, because the legislature used the mandatory word of shall. I see that Judge Riley's screen. Oh, a question.
Judge Larkin, my question is this. It seems that the district court did consider your argument that her potential income from the marital property award should factor into the spousal maintenance determination, but the district court concluded that there wasn't enough of a record or enough evidence to determine with certainty that she would actually get as much income from her award as you're saying she will. What does the case law say about that? I mean, there's always uncertainty when you're dealing with the market. And I mean, unless you have a huge sum of money, you can't necessarily be sure you've got enough to live on.
No, and I totally understand the point, Your Honor. And I think the point is well taken. And I think that the district court, in respondent raised this in their response as well, is that appellant, you know, whose burden is it to provide that information? I think the case law, to answer the court's question, is found, I would direct the court primarily to Lyon v. Lyon, and then Curtis v. Curtis. Lyon coming out of the Supreme Court in 1988, and Curtis coming out of the Supreme Court in 2016. The relevant section to answer the question out of Lyon would be the quote, "One spouse's ability to pay maintenance does not obviate the statutory mandate that the other spouse's own independent financial resources must be considered too." And then that concept is expanded on in Curtis, which says it is expected that a maintenance-seeking spouse will invest cash awards in an effort to meet the spouse's reasonable needs. I argue, Your Honor, that regardless of whether or not appellant did a good or could have done a better job of raising this issue at the district court level, because of the legislative language of shall directing to the district court, not to the parties, and based on the cases I just cited, the burden is still on the district court to make some sort of findings. And I'll make two quick points, and then I'll certainly respond to, well, I think I might have lost Judge Riley. Oh, no, there she is, I apologize. So two points. One is that the fact is the district court did reference in its judgment and decree at page, I'm sorry, I'm skipping ahead a little bit in my argument for me now. In the spousal maintenance section, at page 14, I believe it was, and the quote was that the court says, petitioner relies upon his belief when considering spousal maintenance that respondent will have sufficient liquid assets in the property division to invest and support herself in the future. Again, that's coming out of the party's judgment and decree on page 14. What that tells the court is petitioner did raise this issue. Appellant did raise this issue to the district court. The district court found, again, as in this decision, that it was not, that it was lacking, but is unfair then to say that appellant did not present that issue in argument to the district court, because again, it's referenced within the judgment decree. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm not suggesting you didn't present the argument. What I'm suggesting is you made the argument, the district court heard the argument, and the district court rejected it, in the sense that the district court said, on this record, her ability to earn some income from that marital property is not causing me to change my mind about the amount of permanent spousal maintenance. I mean, it's not a case where the district court ignored your argument. The district court just wasn't persuaded by the record enough to say that her marital property award and the potential for income minus capital gains was enough to change the amount. Isn't that a fair reading of the J&D?
I think that's a fair reading of the J&D, but I don't think that comports with the statute or the cases that are applicable that I cited. Again, yes, Your Honor.
And then my question is, do those cases say, all right, the district court's required to do some math, what's the amount of the property award, what's the projected return in today's economy, what will her capital gains tax be? Or is the district court simply required to say, okay, yes, I recognize she's getting this lump sum of money. I'm not convinced that it's the lump sum that's going to generate significant enough income to reduce her property or her spousal maintenance award. I just wonder, you know, can you point us to a case that says the judge is supposed to do the sort of detailed mathematic analysis you're suggesting is necessary?
No, I don't have a case. If I did, I would probably have put it front and center, Your Honor, as the court would imagine. But I do think that the language is quite clear in Lyon and in Curtis that there is the expectation that will occur. I think when that is combined with the legislature's use of the word shall, I think you put those two concepts together. And again, we can, again, dispute whether or not the district court, you know, consider or didn't consider it. The fact of the matter is, in the J&D, there was no recognition of that. And what's important here, there was no recognition that there would be any investment income. And maybe what could be helpful too is the district court actually notes in its November 11th, 2019 order that it has the obligation to do that. In that order, it states courts must take into account all income of the maintenance requesting spouse, including income generated from marital property received in the dissolution. That's again coming out of Curtis v. Curtis, but that's the district court's order on the post-trial motions in November 11th. But when you read that order further, the district court then doesn't actually consider any of that income, even though it's already stated it. We have that obligation. What it does is it shifts into a discussion of Fink v. Fink, and Fink v. Fink stands for this idea that spousal maintenance should be more than just bare bones needs, meeting the bare bones needs of a recipient. And in essence, that turns appellant's argument into some sort of a claim that we're attacking her need for support in the first place, which isn't true. The the petitioner in this matter stipulated to the award of permanent maintenance voluntarily. Also, the appellant has not raised any argument challenging the monthly needs of respondent as set by the district court, which was found to be $6,465 a month. That's not a bare bones budget, given the fact it includes over $400 in miscellaneous monthly expenses. And finally, before I transition into my conclusion, I would simply note that certainly if we were talking about a de minimis amount, this argument might have more weight, that the court shouldn't have to do math every single time. The reality is respondent was awarded between $610,000 and $660,000 in cash assets. This is not a de minimis amount. Even if you apply a minimal amount of investment return on those numbers, given the fact that her imputed income was $3,000, her budget was $6,400, you're going to start offsetting her needs in a significant way. So I think that the context of the amount that was awarded to respondent also should be considered because it is a significant amount. In conclusion, the district court's spousal maintenance analysis is clearly erroneous as identified by the appellant in this appeal. The district court based its analysis when setting the amount on a 2018 cash flow exhibit rather than appellant's exhibit 96, which was based on the tax laws as they existed when the judgment and decree was issued in May 6, 2019. Under current tax law, it is clear that appellant cannot satisfy his court order spousal maintenance obligation. His reasonable budget is found by the district court and his tax obligation with only his gross monthly income of $8,200. Additionally, the district court committed clear error by failing to consider the income available to respondent from the $610,000 to $660,000 of marital property awarded to her in cash as her share of the marital estate as required by statute. As a result of these errors, ask that the matter be remanded to the district court with instructions to make findings of appellant's ability to pay support, specifically including his net income and the additional income available to respondent to meet her monthly needs. I see my time has ended, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We're ready to hear from counsel for respondent. Would you identify yourself for the record and begin your argument, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Carla Shelberg. Just for the record, I cannot see Judge Riley, so if Judge Riley has a question, I'd ask that it be verbal and not raising hands. But
This is Judge Riley, and I'm having problems with my internet connection, so if I turn my video off, it takes up less bandwidth, but I can see and hear.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. I represent the respondent, Nicole Bothman. First of all, Your Honor, I want to remind the court that this is a case based on the abuse of discretion, and that particularly in maintenance cases, the amount and duration of the maintenance award is committed entirely to the court's broad discretion. And I would quote Erlinson v. Erlinson and Brahms v. Brahms, that it not be decided just on a single statutory factor, but that all of the evidence and all of the factors need to be considered. Counsel misstates Kostelnik. Kostelnik, and I know I'm not pronouncing that right, but that does not say that the court must find a net monthly income. What the court says is that the district court needs to make necessary findings in order to allow for review. And the court did that here. Yes, in that case, it was dismissed or it was reversed, but it was reversed because the facts before it showed that the court's award was beyond its discretion. There is no bright line or bright statement by the court that a net income has to be determined by the court. Let me remind the court of what the district court in this case did find. The district court found that the petitioner, the appellant, was not credible. The district court found that the petitioner, the appellant, destroyed original documents. The district court found that the appellant funneled marital funds through his father's accounts in order to hide marital property. The court found that the appellant will continue to have access to funds under the radar. The court found that it's reasonable that petitioner or the appellant will continue to go back to paying his monthly expenses out of the business and not in a way that makes them taxable. And finally, the court found that the parties lived a very comfortable lifestyle Some would even say viewed as extravagant. I want to also remind the court of the fact that this is not a case where there is a defined amount of income. He does not work for an employer. He does not have W-2 income. He owns a business. And the facts before the court submitted by my client was that his monthly income could be as high, gross monthly income, as $20,000. I don't have the exact number in front of me. That the court weighed the determination of knowing that he's not credible, number one, knowing that he has access to funds that will not be taxed in order to pay his monthly expenses, and came down to the maintenance award. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I think your assessment of how the district court viewed this is right on. I mean, it's sort of a big picture. Where's his money coming from? How much does he really have? However, I do have some concern that the district court seems to have indicated that the 2019 tax law changes mattered because she allowed additional submissions taken into account those changes. And yet, at the end of the day, the district court didn't indicate in its order that it had applied those tax law changes in arriving at its spousal maintenance determination. So that does give me concern, and who knows what would happen on a remand in this case, but how do we overlook the fact that the district court acknowledged that the determination was governed by the 2019 tax laws, and there's no indication that the district court actually then considered them in setting the amount?
We do that, Your Honor, because that was the purpose of the motion for amended findings. Yet, the appellant chose never to raise that issue. If you look at the hearing and if you look at the submissions, they never mentioned Exhibit 96. More than that, Your Honor, they did not mention Exhibit 96 and the fact that she relied on Exhibit 8 in their initial brief. They waited, so I could not respond. They waited until their reply brief. This could have been corrected by the court if it was specifically raised with regard to what exhibit they thought she should rely on. What's more disturbing, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I just want to summarize what you said to make sure I'm understanding. What you're saying is district court offered the opportunity for additional submissions to take into account the 2019 tax changes. She then does not appear to have applied the 2019 tax laws in setting the maintenance amount. And yet, in a subsequent motion for amended findings by husband did not raise that failure and did not raise it until a responsive brief. So you're saying that assigning any assignment of error based on failure to apply the 2019 tax law changes is not properly before this court because it wasn't preserved below? Is that the argument?
That is one of my arguments, Your Honor. It is not the whole argument. The other problem is that the entire transcript was not ordered and it is not before the court. The court does not have the testimony of the expert that submitted Exhibit 8. There is no testimony that accompanies Exhibit 96. There is no way for this court to determine whether that testimony further supported the court's choice of income. And I would say, Your Honor, I was actually kind of surprised. I was not the attorney of record in the trial, obviously. I came on an appeal. That Exhibit 8, if it is stated, does not have any considerations of the new tax law, why on earth it was submitted in a trial of September, the first day was September 23rd, and you know that information, that tax law will change once this judgment decree is entered. it was a choice by the party that is, you have to wonder, and you don't know because you do not have the transcript around that as to why that was even considered. But the other thing, Your Honor, is that the court is well within its discretion to determine that that is not going to be significant based upon the fact that he has access and has regularly used access of non-taxed funds. But we should have a completely different order for the court to review, because it was the appellant's duty to raise that specific argument that they waited until the reply brief here to raise, that the court should have used Exhibit 96 instead of relying on Exhibit 8. And let's just remember that they submitted both of these exhibits. My client submitted an exhibit which showed net income, and I don't have the exact amount, but well exceeding $15,000. If I can move to the next issue, Your Honor. Counsel completely misstates the law with regard to the use of dividend income or interest income from assets. There is no case anywhere that says a court must use this kind of income. And rather, what the cases are is that if the court decides to use that income and makes factual findings to support it, it will not be outside the discretion of the court. But it is not the court's job to make that evidence. There is no justification for that. Appellant did not submit any factual evidence to show what the amount should be imputed. And if the court can remember that we've already dealt with imputed income, my client is already being imputed income that is exactly the amount proposed by their expert. So we're already dealing with imputed income, and to deal with imputed income again, particularly based on a stock market where we can see right now, we can see how that act could be beyond the court's discretion, given how volatile the current stock market is. But most importantly, Your Honor, and Your Honors, the court needs to view this in the context of where it is, and that is that this is not challenging a determination as to whether permanent lifetime maintenance is appropriate. Both parties agreed permanent lifetime maintenance is appropriate. They submitted that to the court. Any issue with regard to the amount of maintenance can be corrected, because this is always in the discretion of the court. And that is particularly important here when the court could not rely on the statements of the appellant with regard to his specific income. If this was a different case where we were talking about the initial determination with regard to invoking the jurisdiction of the court for lifetime spousal maintenance, I think the court might be right to look at it more critically. But here, I would ask the court to look at the entire picture, recognize that both sides agreed that lifetime permanent maintenance was appropriate, recognize that the factual findings in front of the that were made by the court, if you don't just focus on 896, and instead you look at the broad factual findings of the court, they clearly support the determination. The record on the whole supports the determination of the court. You cannot get by the fact that the court made the following findings: that appellant is not credible. I mean, flat out, appellant is not credible. that appellant destroyed original documents, that appellant funneled marital funds through his father's account, that appellant will continue, and this is a factual finding, the appellant will continue to have access to funds under the radar. And if you interpret that, what that means, that's funds that are not taxed. And that the appellant will likely return to his practice of running all of his personal expenses through the business. So the law and the statute asks the reviewing court to look at the entire record and to look at the district court's broad findings with regard to the appropriateness of the maintenance award. And to the extent that the difference between Exhibit 8 and Exhibit 96 concerns the court, I think that court needs to look at the fact that Judge Moss was not given an opportunity to correct that if the court found it to be an error. But more importantly, the totality of her findings support her award. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a rebuttal argument?
Certainly, Your Honor. Very briefly, I'll go to the issue the court asked about more specific language with regard to investment. I would point the court again back to Curtis v. Curtis, but another section of that case found at page 254 of the opinion where it states, and I quote, at the most liquid extreme is cash, comma, which we expect a maintenance-seeking spouse to invest in an effort to meet the spouse's reasonable needs. See Nardini, 414 Northwest 2nd, Brahms, 353 Northwest 2nd, Erlinson v. Erlinson. So again, there is clearer clearer language in the cases from Curtis out of the Supreme Court that there is the expectation of a maintenance-seeking spouse to invest income. With regard to the issue of the kind of the timeline of how we got here, the reason that Exhibit 8 wasn't referenced in Appellant's post-trial motion is because the district court didn't reference how they got to their award of spousal maintenance in the judgment and decree. That's actually Appellant's first point, which is that the court needed to use net income when establishing support. And because the district court did not use net income, it was not clear at the post-trial stage where the district court came up with the number that they did. Because, yes, Judge Larkin.
Why wasn't it clear in post-trial motions, but it's clear now on appeal?
As I said, if you look into the judgment and decree, Your Honor, there is no reference in the judgment and decree with regard to net income. So there is no indication from the district court in the judgment and decree how Judge Moss arrived at $3,500. The appellant raised the issue on the post-trial motion, as you can see from the post-trial motion that I filed on behalf of the party, asking the court to apply a reasonable tax rate to petitioner's gross income, which would show in the argument I'm reading from the motion I filed that he is left with $2,363 per month to contribute to the financial needs. And I break down the net income versus monthly needs of $3,500 to show how I arrived at that amount. Judge Moss then denies that motion, and for the first time in the record, references the cash flow scenarios that she said were submitted by petitioner to support her decision. In fairness to Ms. Shellberg, it wasn't until her responsive brief where Exhibit 8 was attached as respondent's addendum, actually attached that it became clear that the cash flow exhibits that the judge was using were from 2018, because at the bottom of Exhibit 8 attached to respondent's addendum was the date that it was submitted, which was September. Yes, Judge Larkin.
So your response to the argument that this wasn't raised in post-trial motion practice is that you did raise the issue, but you didn't specifically say you were wrong, you used 2018, you should have used 2019, because there was no indication what the district court used in the J&D. It wasn't until you got your ruling on the post-trial motion that it became apparent what the judge did.
it became apparent, at least, that the judge was, Judge Moss was using cash flow scenario submitted by appellant. But that's absolutely right, Your Honor, because, again, just to restate what I think is in appellant's pleadings, without having the net income, there was no way to understand how Judge Moss actually arrived at the number of $3,500. It wasn't actually until respondent attached Exhibit 8 to the addendum and then preparing the reply brief that it became clear that the district court had erroneously, and I'm sure it was an oversight. I actually, you know, have no reason to doubt that it was an oversight. The district court had multiple days of trial, hundreds of pages of paper to sift through, and I have no doubt that it was an oversight. Yes, Your Honor.
What about the argument that even if that was an error, the record as a whole supports this award, given everything the judge did find in terms of his access to assets, non-taxable income, the ability to run expenses through his business. I mean, his ability to have the lifestyle that he's had all along might suggest that even if there was an error, he can afford to pay this.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I note I'm about to run out of time, so I'll respond to the question in two ways. One is that's not the way the judgment and decree reads. The judgment decree actually does a very nice job of arriving at the numbers that it does for gross income and monthly expenses. Judge Moss specifically went through my client's income and claimed expenses to arrive at $3,500 for him, specifically deducted items that were being run through the business from his income, took them out of his expenses. And so the judge actually arrived at very specific numbers for gross income and monthly expenses. The one number the judge did not create a specific number to arrive at was $3,500 for the support award. And when you put the numbers, as I've said, it's a mathematical impossibility for an individual based on the gross income that was found by the district court and the monthly expenses found by the district court to meet all of the obligations they're required to. And to conclude, with regard to the credibility issue, I would simply note that Mr. Bothman was sanctioned by an award of $50,000 against him for attorney's fees that were awarded to respondent. And that issue should be segregated from the actual amount of spousal maintenance, since any credibility or character flaws that Mr. Bothman was found to have was adequately compensated in the award of attorney's fees to respondent. Unless there are further questions, I'll conclude my argument.
I don't see any additional questions from the panel. Thank you to both of the attorneys for your arguments and for your willingness to appear on WebEx this morning, given the restrictions we're operating under at the court. The matter is well argued. It's submitted. You'll have our decision.